Paul sat in the pilot seat of the Soviet helicopter and shifted the radio's frequency to the frequency of Eden 1. Rather than remount the ship's guns, he decided he'd seen John and Natalia fly often enough that he felt he could get airborne. He couldn't maneuver enough to really fly and had no conception of how to land any sort of aircraft, but he could get the chopper airborne and into position to use the missiles. He thought of Annie, perhaps dead already. If he died and she lived, perhaps she would find someone else. Tears filled Paul's eyes. It was insane loving her, but he did. But saving her brother was more important than saving himself, saving John's son, and the 20 cryogenic sleep passengers and 3 crew members of Eden 1. To save all of them was more important than one life when the one life was his. Eden 1 would be starting its approach soon, very soon. Natalia Anastasia Temirovna, fighting the nausea, fighting her bone-deep fatigue, banked the Soviet helicopter, following in the wake of Rort's machine, Kuranami behind her as they convoyed the 3 ships toward what she prayed would be the final conflict with her husband, to intercept him and prevent him from slaughtering Michael and Paul. Sarah Rort sat strapped beside her in the co-pilot's seat.
Why were you and Annie and the others coming to rescue me?
You came to rescue us, didn't you?
Natalia realized she hadn't been looking at the controls, and she turned away from Sarah.
But as soon as we get on the ground, you get into some clothes. You should see how ridiculous you look in Annie's slip and no shoes and John's leather jacket.
I feel ridiculous.
What?
I feel ridiculous.
Her feet and legs were mud-splattered. The slip clung to her thighs, and the leather jacket was so big for her that she had rolled back the sleeves to her elbows so she could work the controls of the helicopter.
Ridiculous.
Captain Timothy Dodd marked re-entry progress with his flight officer, Craig Lerner.
Coming out of entry interface communications blackout on my mark.
My instruments checked, Tim.
Science officer Jeff Stiles monitored vehicle status.
Tiles cooling to acceptable level.
Marked.
Dot hit the comm switch.
Paul Rubenstein to Eden 1, over.
We're with you, Mr. Rubenstein.
Dodd consulted his readouts.
Altitude, 34 miles. Airspeed, 8,270, plus, and dropping at acceptable level. ETA to you, 12 minutes. We are committed to your landing site. Talk to you later. Dodd out.
Dodd studied the computer display screens on his control panel.
Switching to CRTs. Craig, on my mark.
Ready to begin terminal area energy management.
Mark.
On CRTS, TAEM, fully functional.
Entry flight profile good. Looking for waypoint 1.
First gas tank on the left, Skipper.
Thanks for that. Making the S-turn.
S-turn looking good, Skipper.
Making for waypoint 1.
CRTS looking good, Skipper. Time for a video game if we hurry.
After we hit the ground.
Please, don't use the word hit, say land.
Coming up on waypoint 1.
Looking good on the CRTS, TAEM, right on the money, Skipper.
Roger that, Jeff. Ideal trajectory, so far.
Keep encouraging me.
Hitting altitude direction indicator to correct for slight nose pitch.
ADI on the money, Skipper.
Horizontal situation indicator puts us right where we should be. I need a roger on that, Jeff.
Big affirmative on HSI. Looks just like a simulator flight.
Well, you guys cut it out. You know landings make me nervous.
Vertical velocity indicator okay to you, Jeff?
Roger on that one too, Skipper. Just like the storks dropping us.
Jeez, guys.
Dodd studied the alpha Mach meter to the left of the ADI and HSI panels.
Arriving, waypoint 1. 5 minutes on my mark.
Dodd studied the CRTS, the small box showing his position in the orbiter's immediate future. The box moved into the cylinder.
Mark, 5 minutes to waypoint 1.
Blast! I didn't pack my toothbrush!
All right, be that way.
Speed brake handle to 65%. Moving now.
They were entering the cylinder. When Dodd did it on the simulators, and the 2 times before that he did it for real, this always seemed like the ultimate commitment. No chance to play the controls and fly by the seat of the pants. No chance for anything but to bring her in and to land her. Dodd's palms sweated now as he watched himself and his ship moving closer to the cylinder on the CRT display. Dodd thought of Craig Lerner, his flight officer.
Anybody got the instruction booklet? I think I forgot to do something a couple of minutes back.
Man!
Captain Andrei Popovsky turned in his co-pilot seat to Colonel Karamazov.
Comrade Khan, Eden 1 is estimated 5 minutes from touchdown on the landing field prepared for them along the highway.
Karamazov reached forward and jabbed the pilot of the machine.
Pilot, ETA at the road campsite, quickly.
Comrade Colonel, almost exactly 4 minutes.
Comrade Colonel, headquarters indicated the approach pattern should last 80 seconds after the space shuttle comes out of the turn and toward the landing zone for touchdown.
Babowski, have the pilot plot an intercept course so we can follow the shuttle in. It will be like in a shooting gallery. A popular thing once in America. Did you ever try one, Babowski?
No, Comrade Colonel. I have been
fascinated.
Karamazov raised an imaginary rifle to his shoulder, squinting along its imaginary barrel at its imaginary front sight, not really seeing the rain falling in torrents around the speeding helicopter, but seeing a tiny two-dimensional space shuttle, all in white, moving along a rail, with it ducks and tiny bullseyes, and tracking him with his eye.
Pow!
He looked at Popovsky.
Just like a shooting gallery, Popovsky. And then, after the space shuttle is in flames and all aboard are dead, we strafe the Rourke campsite, we kill Michael Rourke and Rourke's Jew friend, then we fire our missiles into the highway surface and destroy it, so the remaining craft of the Eden Project fleet cannot use the site for landing, ever. Perhaps they will be unable to land and simply die there in the cold of space. Yes. Someday the night sky will be bright as one by one the space shuttles lose their orbits and burn up on the re-entry into the atmosphere. Then the last of these fools who believe in democracy will be dead. And we can hunt John Rourke and my wife, and Rourke's wife and daughter and the other girl and the black woman with them and the Japanese. Hunt them and destroy them.
This is John Rourke to Captain Dodd on Eden 1. Come in. Over.
Dr. Rourke, a little busy now. Touchdown in just a little while. Over.
I know as much about your touchdown schedule as you do. I'm flying one of the Soviet craft. I've been monitoring their communications. I'm sure Natalia and your Lieutenant Kurenami are doing the same in their craft. There's a fleet of approximately 8 Soviet gunships ready to intercept your descent pattern in approximately 3 minutes, just in time to shoot you down as you attempt to land. Can you do anything to change course and kill time until we can attempt to eliminate the threat? Over.
You should be familiar with our procedures, Dr. Rourke. You already know the answer to that one, I'm sure. We have 6 M16s stashed aboard and 180 rounds of ammo for each, plus 3.45 pistols with 21 rounds apiece. Can't open a window and shoot at them. Anyway, all of us are a little busy. Any chance there are bad shots? Over.
I wouldn't count on that, Captain. We're moving into the area at maximum speed, burning like a 57 Chevy. So hang in there and pray a little. Rourke out.
God bless us all, Doctor. Eden 1 out.
Rourke held to the same frequency.
Rourke calling Paul. Come in, Paul. Rourke calling Rubenstein. Come in. Over.
I've been monitoring you, John, and monitoring Eden 1. I got the gunship's machine gun set to fire against any attack force. And I got something else up my sleeve if I have to. Michael's holding on. Dodd has the same blood type, and the science officer can give a transfusion if he has to. Michael will be okay. Over.
Paul, get Michael into the Ford and drive out of there. The two of you will be sitting ducks on the ground. Over.
How's Annie and the others? Over.
Annie's fine, and Sarah and Natalia and Madison and Halverson and Kurenami. But get out of there. Over.
Negative, John. Michael's safe, but he's too weak for me to move him. I have this crate airborne and can use my missiles to defend Eden 1. Over.
Bullshit, Paul. You're not a pilot. Over.
Anybody can get an aircraft off the ground and push a fire control switch. The hard part's landing. I can see Eden 1. Hell, I can hear her. Gotta go. Tell Annie I do love her. Rubenstein out.
Rourke started to answer, but Annie broke in from Kurenami's helicopter.
Paul, you only get yourself killed. Do as Daddy says. I love you. I don't want you to die.
If I make it, well, can I have Captain Dodd into marrying us? If I don't, then forget me. I love you. I love all of you. Why the hell you think I'm doing this? Paul out.
Paul! Paul!
Rourke stared at the airspeed indicator. The tachometer was almost redlining if he read it right.
Natalia, Lieutenant, I'm gonna redline this thing. Push for maximum speed. You follow at your present speed. If I blow this sucker up, at least your ship will still be functional. Work out.
Rourke flicked off the radio. He didn't want to hear Natalia and Sarah telling him not to do what he was going to do. He looked at Madison.
I'm sorry it's like this. I mean...
Father Rourke,
You love Paul Rubenstein very much. I would expect nothing less from you.
Her pretty pale blue eyes seemed to smile at him, and Rourke reached across to her and squeezed both her hands. Then he released her hands, let the throttle all the way out, and he prayed. Paul Rubenstein followed the Eden One communications. They began something called Autoland Guidance. He wished he had it as he hovered above the Georgia plane.
Pilot seat? Wrong place for me.
He brought with him two M16s and spare magazines, though he doubted there'd be time to use the spares. The Schmeisser, the battered Browning High Power, the first gun he ever owned, tight in the tanker holster across his chest. After he fired the full complement of missiles, he would use the machine guns. Once they ran out, he'd try to use the M16s, then the Schmeisser and the High Power. Until the machine crashed, or until he had no more ammunition for the guns, he would keep fighting. Yes, he would keep fighting. Even if John and Natalia and Lieutenant Kuranami arrived in time with their gunships, they would be outnumbered by more than 2-1. Perhaps he could make a difference, Paul Rubenstein told himself. He reached his trembling hand up to the bridge of his nose for his glasses. They weren't there. Since awakening from the cryogenic sleep, he had no need for the glasses. Still, a lifetime habit was hard to break. Now, here he was about to break all habits. He smiled.
Once and forever.
He looked below, toward the tent on the far side of the campsite, well away from the road. He prayed Michael would live. Before the night of the war, he found every excuse not to go to Temple. Since the night of the war, he often wished there were still a Temple to go to. He thought of his father and his mother, how it was on the holidays. He thought of the first time he was allowed to light the candles. Paul felt tears in his eyes and wiped them away with the back of his right hand so he could see. In the distance, to his right, as the machine spun for a moment, he could see the shape of Eden One. From the very first shuttle flight, he watched every launch and landing, every tragedy and triumph. The shuttles were more than space vehicles to Paul. They symbolized good hard work, the wonder of technology, the genius of human striving, and the marvels it produced. They fascinated him, filled him with awe, and made him offer a silent prayer for the safety of the crew. He felt the same prayer now in his heart. It was a prayer for humanity. To Paul's left, through the swirling, liquid dark of the night, eight black shapes like giant wasps, shapes identical to his craft, the Soviet gunship force. Vladimir Karamazov in the lead burst his reverie. He knew somehow it must be Karamazov. The sadistic maniac would not miss it. Slowly, Paul Rubenstein worked the controls, trying to determine what was what.
Come on.
Slowly, the machine turned to face the oncoming gunships. He worked the switch to arm the missiles. The targeting computer display appeared on the console.
All right, assholes. Time to get circumcised.
His hands stopped trembling. He was ready to die now. The helicopter vibrated around John Rourke and Madison.
I think this flying machine is about to fall to pieces, Father Rourke.
Rourke didn't look at her. He studied the eight black shapes on the far horizon.
If she hasn't already, she won't now. I hope. I'll tell you what, though. If anything starts overheating or lighting on fire, I want you to pick up the fire extinguisher in the red can on the floor to the left of your seat, pull the ring on its side, and spray at the base of the flame. You got it?
Yes, Father Rourke.
Thanks, Madison.
You're welcome. Father Rourke, why is a flying machine called she?
Vehicles are temperamental, sometimes unpredictable, like a woman.
I was always taught to be even-tempered to control excesses.
Well, there's a fallacy there. Men are just as temperamental, they're just as unpredictable. Except men mask their emotions more than women do. Calling an aircraft by a woman's name is just an outgrowth of a more chauvinistic era.
What is chauvinistic,
chauvinistic. Like assuming women always need help with things. Protecting women, the man taking the responsibility.
You are... one of these?
Rourke looked at her and smiled.
How could you tell?
Rourke set his attention on the eight craft growing on the horizon. Beyond them, falling like a star from the heavens, he could see Eden One between sweeps of the wipers across the windshield.
Looks like the shuttle is slowing below 500 mph. They should be touching down in a couple of minutes.
The eight black gunship shapes were spreading into some sort of attack formation. John Rourke punched up his weapon systems consoles.
Madison, keep that M16 handy, and the other ones too.
She had them beside her in the co-pilot's chair.
When we get into this, you can ram one of those out the storm vent beside you. The brass will go into the back of the ship and shouldn't hit the control panels. We'll need all the firepower we can get.
Aim for the rotors, the blades spinning on top of the machines, or for the open side doors. You can get some of the personnel aboard, maybe. I'll be moving fast, so watch you don't bump your head on the glass.
No, Father Rourke. I will not worry.
Rourke picked one chopper as his immediate target and altered course to intercept it. What worried him most was the solitary helicopter, which hovered somehow strangely near the roadside that was to be the runway. He knew the pilot, knew him like his brother. The eight enemy helicopters broke into what Paul Rubinstein recognized as an attack formation. There was a ninth helicopter, some distance further back, closing fast. It would be John Rourke, but John would be too late unless Paul acted to break up the formation. Paul Rubinstein aimed the attack computer on the nearest of the gunships. He activated the fire control switch for the primary starboard missiles that Paul had reloaded after John Rourke used missiles to destroy the bridges. Paul watched the contrail. The lead chopper seemed to stall in midair. Then bits and pieces of it flew everywhere as a huge black and orange fireball encircled and vaporized the gunship. There was a contrail coming toward him. Paul Rubinstein fired again. The missiles crossed, he guessed, less than a dozen yards from each other. His own ship shuddered again, the missile missing his craft by inches.
Didn't think I'd just sit here, did ya?
The second missile he fired connected, another of the gunships, a ball of yellow and orange flame. He made to fire a third missile. One of the gunship's machine guns tore into Paul's craft. Rubinstein tried to turn his machine as he fired his machine guns. The plexiglass of the dome shattered around him. Fire burned inside him as he doubled forward, his right fist locked on the aircraft's throttle, his left hand trying to find the fire control switch to mass fire the remaining missiles. He found it and depressed the switch. Cold engulfed Paul, and blackness shrouded his eyes.
Daddy.
John Rourke fired port and starboard missiles, one each. Both missiles targeted on the gunship that fired on Paul Rubinstein. Somehow, Rubinstein's craft stayed airborne, with its plexiglass cockpit bubble shattered and smoke billowing from the fuselage.
Fuck you!
Rourke screamed the words into the teardrop-shaped microphone before his lips, the radio set to the Russian frequency. As the contrails wove toward the target, the gunship started to turn.
That was the little Jew?
The gunship that fired on Paul Rubinstein vaporized in another fireball. Another of the black gunships banked sharply and suddenly away from it. The rain was so heavy now, the wipers in front of the cockpit did virtually no good, and the defrosters at full power couldn't keep the interior of the plexiglass from steaming over.
Madison, take a rag or something and wipe the windshield for me. Clear the glass so I can see.
Rourke swung the helicopter starboard. Rubinstein's machine was still airborne. Rourke switched frequencies to the shuttle frequency. Paul's radio would be set to it.
Paul! Come in! Paul! Paul! Natalia, get in here, you and Kurinami. We're getting those bastards now.
Rourke glanced to his left. Eden 1 was coming in, approaching the runway surface. Two of the remaining five gunships broken off, starting an attack run.
Natalia, you and Kurinami go after the other three. Get them. I'm going in after the two that broke off.
Rourke glanced at Madison.
Hang on, kid.
He throttled out, starting down after the two gunships.
I am hanging on, Father Rourke.
The space shuttle deployed landing gear.
Shit!
The two gunships dogged the shuttlecraft now, one on each side. A missile contrail snaked after the shuttle and missed, driving into the ground to the far starboard side of the Eden 1 craft. Rourke leveled off, not risking his missiles, and armed the gunship's machine gun. He was flying over the shuttlecraft now, the size and speed of the shuttle sucking him along in its wake. Rourke fired his machine guns toward the enemy gunship to port, as another missile contrail sailed wide of the shuttle. The space shuttle's rear wheels touched down and screeched above the roar of the engines. The Eden 1 craft vibrated, twisting beneath him. More machine gun fire poured from both Soviet helicopters as the shuttle's nose wheel touched down. Rourke banked slightly, throttling back, cutting 45 degrees to starboard, firing his portside missiles in cluster. The enemy gunship dogging the shuttlecraft's starboard side vaporized. Another contrail flew from the enemy gunship. Another miss driving into the sand along the side of the road as the shuttlecraft slowed to less than 200 miles per hour and skidded insanely along the wet road surface.
Hold on, Madison!
The girl fired her M16 at the enemy ship. Rourke cut off his fire control computer. The machine gun's on manual now. The distance between the enemy gunship and the slowing Eden 1 too close to risk a missile.
Should we break off, Comrade Kerlo? The American pursues us over.
This is Colonel Karamazov. Destroy Eden 1 or answer to me.
Rourke touched the machine gun fire control switch. The gunship climbed perpendicular to the ground, pirouetted as the shuttle rolled clear, then spun off in a 45-degree dive.
Hang in there, Eden One. I got him off your back. Rourke out.
Rourke banked the gunship hard to starboard, crossing over Eden One's dorsal side, turning the craft 90 degrees, leveling off, closing toward the last three gunships. Natalia's and Kuranami's crafts were exchanging missiles with them, all five craft using evasive maneuvers, the missiles impacting the desert sands beneath them. Rourke switched back to the Soviet frequency.
You must provide covering fire. You will be remembered. You will be avenged.
One of the three enemy gunships broke off, heading southeast. Another of the gunships exploded as Natalia's craft veered away. Rourke activated his remaining starboard missiles, Kuranami's machine guns fired, and Natalia's opened up as well. The bubble of the enemy gunship disintegrated. Flames leaped skyward, and the body of a man, a human torch, vaulted through the flames into midair an instant before his ship disintegrated. Rourke banked hard to starboard, Karamazov's gunship disappearing over the horizon, the rain as heavy as it had been. That it could fall more heavily seemed impossible as Rourke stared after Karamazov. Rourke glanced to his right. Eden One had stopped. He glanced below to his left. The tent where he left Michael at the far edge of the campsite and away from the road looked untouched. Then Rourke turned the aircraft 180 degrees. Somehow, Paul Rubinstein's crippled gunship still hovered over the desert, perhaps 800 feet up. Rourke switched to the common frequency with Natalia's and Kuranami's crafts.
Natalia, you know how to give a transfusion. So does Sarah. Touch down and start Michael with Sarah's blood. As soon as Annie reaches you, connect her so you can switch to her when Sarah's through. Over.
What about...
I said I'll get him, and I will. Take care of Michael. Have Kuranami meet when I land. Hurry. Out.
Rourke started the machine down.
Madison, I think there's a shoulder-fired grappling hook cannon. See if you can find it.
A what?
A big three-pronged hook on the end of a rope sticking out of a tube.
I have seen such a thing. It is put away back there.
Stowed. You say stowed. Well, get quick. When I touch down, get out and get Kuranami aboard.
You are going to try to save Mr. Rubinstein.
Rourke looked at her.
Yeah, I am. I am.
Rourke idled the engine and went to the midsection of the chopper, staring out into the rain for a moment through the open fuselage door. He watched as Madison ran toward Kuranami's landing chopper. The ground turned to oozing mud, the rain lashing at the ground and at the gunships. Rourke dropped to a crouch, checking the grappling hook's connection to the rope and examining the firing instructions for the cannon. With the 50 meters of rope indicated on the instructions, he figured he had enough to do the job. Rourke undid his gun belt from his waist, stowing it under one of the seats. He slipped off his shoulder holsters and put them beside his musette bag and his binoculars, then stowed them with the Python's gun belt. The Detonic Scoremasters he pulled from his belt and set them away. Rourke threaded the sheath of the big Gerber MK2 into his trouser belt. It would be all he needed.
Madison says you require my assistance, Doctor.
Yeah, you're a good pilot and I don't need your blood type. We're taking this crate up as close as we can to get Paul Rubinstein and that helicopter just hovering out there.
It is on fire. It will explode at any moment.
Electrical fire. Could take a long time.
Rourke followed Kuranami's eyes to the grappling hook.
You wish.
You got it. I get this grappling hook attached, then I climb over to Paul's machine, get aboard, and put out the fire and bring her home.
Rourke moved back to the cockpit.
You take the pilot's controls. I'll ride co-pilot until we get into position.
But Dr. Rourke, your friend, he is probably already dead.
Rourke started strapping himself into the co-pilot seat.
If he is, I'll bring his body back. At least Paul can have a decent burial that way. Come on, you said yourself, the ship could explode any minute.
The radius of a single main rotor blade for the Soviet gunships, Rourke guessed at about 36 feet. Doubling that radius, plus another 12 to 20 feet, meant Rourke needed at least 92 feet of rope. With 50 meters of rope on the grappling hook, he had plenty. Rourke slipped a gun belt through his pants belt and secured it to the wall frame of his craft. Rourke sat down on the deck of the chopper, swung his legs out the starboard door, and braced his heels against the runner. The cannon had one charge. His shot must count. Shoot the hook too high, and the line could foul the rotor, destroy the turbine, pull him out the door, possibly bringing down both craft. Shoot it too low, and they would have to go down to get the cannon from one of the other ships, but who knew how much time remained for Paul's craft. The chopper danced in the swirling winds, and somehow Paul's craft hovered alongside them.
Akira, ready?
Rourke hefted the cannon to his shoulder.
I am ready, Doctor, if you are ready.
Best pilot in the Japanese Navy, right?
Helicopters were not my specialty.
You know, I really didn't need to know that, Akira.
All right, let's go. Just remember, there's not that much extra rope. After we hook up, you can't get beyond 150 feet or you'll snap the rope or make both ships crash.
I am aware of these. Dog of the moon, huh?
You bet. Let's go.
Rourke clicked off the cover of the firing mechanism and aimed for the open door of Paul's chopper.
Looking good, Lieutenant.
Thank you, Doctor. I thought so myself.
Ready?
Rourke let out half a breath and held his finger over the trigger. A downdraft of wind bucked the gunships. Rourke and Kuranami's craft dropped 50 feet below Paul's craft that somehow remained airborne. As Rourke slammed into the side of the door opening, grateful his makeshift safety belt held.
Damn it.
I am sorry, Doctor. We will try again.
You bet we will.
The chopper rose again. Rourke lined up the cannon for another attempt. The hook shot through the wind and rain, slammed against the far wall of Paul's ship, and bounced back toward the open door. All Rourke could do was watch as the hook bounced twice and caught.
Sweet.
Rourke pulled in the slack to yank the hook tight and secure the line. He looped his end of the cord, pulled the Gerber, and sawed through the extra, leaving enough to secure his end to Kuranami's bird. Rourke gave the rope one last yank to secure the hook. The rope went slack, the bottom fell out of his stomach, and he watched as the hook slid across the floor of Paul's chopper headed for the open door and dropped out. The hook clanged against the runner and caught.
We are lucky men, Dr. Rourke.
Skill! It's all it ever is.
Rourke reached into his hip pocket for his gloves.
I'm ditching the headset now and starting to cross. If the ship Paul's on looks like it's about to go, I'll cut the line and you'll get the hell out.
I will stay. Thank you. Borrowed aircraft anyway, but hurry!
Right!
Rourke ripped the headset away, throwing it behind him into the fuselage and unbuckled his safety harness. He edged out onto the lip of the craft, both hands over the rope. He hooked his right leg over the rope behind his knee. His left leg swung free, and Rourke pulled with his hands and his right leg, getting his left leg up and over the rope. He looked down to a drop of at least 800 feet. As he looked up, the downdraft of the rotor blades washed his eyes with rain. He squinted his eyes shut against it. No way to wipe the water away.
Shit.
He edged his left hand forward, then his right. His knees pressed tight around the rope as he inched ahead, hand over hand. The rope vibrating maddeningly, taut one moment, slack the next. The rain hammering down at him, his gloves saturated. John Rourke craned his neck to look ahead. More than 100 feet remained until he reached the smoking, stricken helicopter, his friend. He kept moving, hand over hand, the interior of his gloves wet now. His body shivering with the cold rain and the feeling of being suspended on a thread over the abyss.
Paul, I'll be there. I'm on my way, Paul. You hang on. Don't move. Don't touch those controls. I'm coming. Hang on.
Rourke closed his eyes against the rain. He saw Natalia's face, the terror that had been there, the blue of her eyes, the horror they saw, and he thought his fatigue was that of a 500-year-old man. Rourke drew himself onward. He would save Paul. Then he would follow Vladimir Karamazov to Russia, if that was where Karamazov went, to the ends of the earth, if that was where, to kill him.
Paul!
That Natalia was so abused and degraded, that Michael was shot and might still die, that Paul willingly sacrificed and might now be dead, drove Rourke on. It was not hatred, Rourke knew. Hatred wasted energy, denied thinking. It was the need to exterminate something unspeakably vile. Rourke thought, move one hand forward, then another, then again. Move right, then left. His arms were past aching now, his hands stiff, the fingers like claws. He forced his body along the rope. John Rourke looked toward Rubenstein's gunship. Less than 20 feet remained, but Rourke kept moving. Right, left, right, left, right. His left hand felt something hard. The huge knot at the end of the hook, actually 6 knots in one. 8 inches past this knot, he could see the runner. One thrust and he was there. Rourke hooked his right hand over the runner, then his left, clamping both hands together, resting the fingers, hanging from the rope only by his legs. He hooked one, then the other elbow over the runner, sagging down from it. He forced his fingers and hands to respond. He moved his right hand along the length of the runner, the fingers closing over it, his muscles screaming at his brain to stop the insanity. He closed the fingers of his left hand over the runner. He threw his body from the rope, his right hand shifting along the length of the runner, his left holding on, his right leg free of the rope, swinging wildly in the air, his left leg groping, hooking over the after end of the runner. Smoke billowed around him. He was near the fuselage door. Brooke looked up. Insulation was burning. He could smell it. With his left hand, he reached for the lip of the fuselage door, closing over it. He swung his right leg up over the runner now. Brooke braced his right hand against the fuselage door at the side, and he twisted his right leg beneath him, bracing his right foot against the runner, thrusting himself forward, falling through the billowing smoke and into the helicopter. Brooke kept low to avoid sucking in the smoke billowing from the front of the gunship. His eyes streamed water, but it was tears from the smoke now. Brooke pulled himself to his knees and crawled forward beneath the smoke.
Bob!
Brooke reached the cockpit and saw Paul Rubinstein slumped over the right side of the pilot's chair, his face gray, drawn, blood trickling from the right corner of his mouth. Brooke checked for a pulse. It was weak, but Paul was alive.
Hang in there, buddy!
The fire was centered on the co-pilot's side of the control panel. The wind and rain swirling through the shattered window on Paul's side of the chopper kept the smoke out of his lungs. If Paul hadn't lost too much blood, chances were good he'd survive. Rourke unlashed the fire extinguisher from the floor next to the co-pilot's seat, pulled the ring, and aimed at the fire.
Go out, you son of a bitch!
Hurry!
The control panel looked like a cream pie, but the fire was out. A gust of rain blew through the shattered windshield, and the panel became an oozy, molten mess. Brooke took hold of the controls with his right hand. Paul's body braced the controls. Move him too fast or the wrong way, and the helicopter would go wildly out of control. He gently eased the younger man back. Brooke found the autopilot switch on the pilot's side of the control panel. He hoped the helicopter systems were redundant. He also hoped the fire hadn't destroyed all the electronics.
Come on, baby.
He hit the switch. Brooke explored Rubenstein's chest and abdomen. Both lungs seemed inflated, as best Brooke could tell. But there was a wound, bleeding heavily, in the left side of the neck. Brooke reached into his pocket and found his bandana. He packed the bandana against Rubenstein's neck, pulling the harness for Paul's tanker holster up to secure it there.
We're gonna bring this baby home, Paul.
Brooke clambered back to the open side door, sat down in the opening, braced his feet against the runner, and pulled in some slack on the rope binding the two gunships. He looked across the void and saw Kuranami watching. Brooke lifted the grappling hook from the runner, waved to Kuranami, and let the hook go. Kuranami's bird rose and banked into the dark. It was up to Rourke now to get them home.
John? Are you... Are you dead too?
Neither one of us is dead yet, Paul. Just hang in there. We'll be safe in a minute here. Paul, I gotta move you now. Can you help me?
His eyes closed, then opened again.
Yeah.
I gotta get into the pilot seat to get us down. I can't use the co-pilot side. The fire destroyed its controls.
Fire?
Later, Paul. We gotta move you now, okay? Okay, Paul. Let's go.
I didn't mean it to be like... But I did what...
Is that what you did, Paul? Mike would be dead and Eden 1 would have been destroyed. You're the hero of the day. But I gotta get us down now, okay? Rest easy, old friend.
Paul Rubinstein nodded his head once and his eyes closed. Rourke checked for a pulse. It was somehow slightly stronger. Rourke nodded to his friend.
Rest easy. Annie's waiting for you.
Rourke reached up and flipped off the autopilot. John Rourke sagged to his knees, then fell flat into the mud. Natalia knelt in the mud beside him. Sarah held his head in her hands. Suddenly, the weight was gone.
We're clear, Lieutenant.
The voice was different, yet familiar. John Rourke rolled over onto his back. Natalia pulled his gloves from his hands. Sarah Rourke cradled his head in her lap.
You're done.
Rourke looked up through the rain at a tall, prematurely gray man dressed in sodden, once white, coveralls.
I bet after all that you're even glad to see me, Dr. Rourke. I'd offer to shake your hands, but your hands don't look too good right now.
Michael, how's...
Mr. Stiles says Michael should make it. They've already begun the cryogenic awakening for their doctor on board. They began it when they touched down. And Annie and I both gave him blood.
Our doctor will be on the job soon.
Paul! He needs it!
You can tell me what to do. Use my hands. We can stabilize Mr. Rubinstein until our doctor is up and around.
Jeff will do a great job in the meantime, Doctor. When I was in Vietnam, well, I saw men shot up worse than live. I'll bet you have, too.
Rourke only nodded. Natalia and Sarah flanked him now, helping him to sit up. His back muscles tightened, but he could still breathe. He could see Paul now, Annie caressing his face, supporting his head as Elaine Halverson, Madison, and another of the astronauts, Rourke guest Flight Officer Lerner, eased him onto a blanket stretcher. Jeff Stiles headed off to help.
Excuse me, gotta check on our patient.
Rourke sat up more.
I'll be all right. Have Kuranami keep one of the choppers ready to go airborne. The two of you?
He looked at Sarah and then at Natalia.
Organize some sort of defensive posture for the camp. We still have those Nazis and their gunships north of us somewhere. And there could be some stragglers from Karamazov's force passing this way.
Rourke started to his feet.
Wait.
Sarah reached out her right hand and held Natalia's right hand. And she bent her face toward him and kissed Rourke's mouth hard once.
For a while. Well, I forgot the one thing I always did love about you, and always will, no matter how the three of us work out. What you did for Paul, well, it reminded me.
Sarah got to her feet, picked up an M16, and started running through the rain toward Kuranami's helicopter as it started up. Wolfgang Mann belted his trench coat about his waist, pulled his cap low over his forehead, then jumped from the fuselage door of his gunship into the mud. He recognized the 3rd Corps Hauptsturmfuhrer as the man ran across the mud-soaked field toward him.
Weil, your report.
Mann cupped his gloved hands around the flame of his lighter as he fired a cigarette. He had tasted a sample of the tobacco grown under lights once, and it was bad. But the crops grown outside the complex yielded a satisfying smoke, and complex scientists 50 years ago found a method to remove all possible carcinogens. He had known nothing better, he reflected.
All of the Soviet personnel who escaped on the ground have been accounted for, Herr Standartenfuhrer.
He saluted.
Prisoners?
No, Herr Standartenfuhrer. 3 of the Soviets committed suicide, regrettably.
And what of the others? The ones who left the field?
The Soviet gunships were tracked, Herr Standartenfuhrer. There was a battle, and also... But it seems impossible.
But why?
One of the space shuttlecraft written about in the history books, those utilized by the Americans before the war between the superpowers, it landed, Herr Standartenfuhrer.
Take no action. Keep the area under surveillance, but do not alert any personnel in the area to our presence. That is understood?
Yes, Herr Standartenfuhrer.
The Hauptsturmfuhrer raised his hand in salute, Mann again only nodding as the man turned on his heel and ran off across the field. Wolfgang Mann, descendant of one of the highest-ranking members of the SS to survive the Second World War, studied the glowing tip of his cigarette and considered the possibilities. Rain poured down from his cap brim, his trouser legs beneath the protection of the trench coat already soaked. A space shuttle. Americans still alive and fighting Russians, and for that matter, the Russians themselves. The key, Mann reflected, walking back toward his helicopter to get in out of the rain, would be to somehow turn these diverse elements to his advantage. To occupy the 1st and 2nd Corps with the pursuit of the Russians, and then to form some sort of alliance, perhaps with the Americans. Wolfgang Mann recalled words as best he could of the British Prime Minister Sir Winston Churchill. Mann was more smitten with the mistakes of history than its aphorisms, but he thought the phrase had something to do with making an alliance with the devil himself to defeat Hitler.
With the devil himself.
Mann shrugged, snapped the cigarette into the dark rain, and climbed back into his attack helicopter. He, too, would make an alliance to defeat Hitler's more than 24 generations removed successor. With the devil, or with the men who believed in freedom, as did he. He stood in the doorway and looked through the rain to the east. There was light on the horizon. Survivalist Reprisal is a Graphic Audio production. Copyright 1985, Jerry Ahern. Published by arrangement with Jerry and Sharon Ahern, all rights reserved. Production copyright 2009, The Cutting Corporation, all rights reserved. Performed by Terrence Aselford, Mort Shelby, Karen Carbone, Nanette Savard, Michael Glenn, James Konacek, M.B. Van Dorn, Eric Messner, Elizabeth Demery, Colleen Delaney, Dylan Lynch, Jeff Baker, Lily Beacon, Stephen Carpenter, Michael John Casey, Dolores King-Williams, Scott McCormick, Tony Nam, Tom Simpson, and Ken Jackson. Additional red shirts by The Dead Giveaways. Directed by Timothy Lynch. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing and graphic audio sound design by Johann Detweiler. Adapted for graphic audio by Timothy Lynch. With original music by Johann Detweiler. If you enjoyed The Survivalist, be sure to look for writer Stacy's Doomsday Warrior, available at Road Stops Everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net, where you'll find samples of all our Action Pump titles, as well as free downloadable extras, forums, and podcasts. Keep listening for a preview of another Graphic Audio title.
The demon dactyl came awake. It didn't seem such a momentous thing, just a gradual stirring in a deep cave in a far, empty mountain. An unnoticed event, seen by none save the caveworms and those few insomniacs among the bevy of weary bats hanging from the high ceiling. But the demon spirit had awakened, had come back from its long dormancy into the statue-like form it had left behind after its last visit to the world called Corona. The tangible, corporeal body felt good to the wandering spirit. The dactyl could feel its blood, hot blood, coursing through its wings and mighty legs, could feel the twitching of its mighty muscles. Its eyes flickered open, but saw only blackness, for the form, left standing in magical stasis in the deep cave, head bowed and wings wrapped tightly about its torso, had been covered by magma. Most of the fiery stuff of that time long past had bubbled and flowed away from the cavern, but enough had remained to harden about the dactyl's corporeal form. The spirit had come back to Corona, encased in obsidian. The demon's spirit felt deep within itself, summoned its powers, both physical and magical. By sheer will and brute strength, the dactyl flexed its wings. A thin crack ran down the center of the obsidian sarcophagus. The dactyl flexed again. It stretched its great wings out to the side, clawed tips grasping and rending the air. The dactyl threw back its head and opened wide its mouth. It voiced the sheer joy of its return, the anticipation of the chaos it would bring again to the quiet human kingdoms of Corona. Its torso resembled that of a tall, slender man, shaped and lined by corded strands of taut muscle and sporting a pair of tremendous bat-like wings, 20 feet across when fully extended, and with strength enough to lift a full-grown bull in swift flight. Its head, too, was somewhat human, except more angular, with a narrow jaw and pointed chin. The dactyl's ears were pointed as well, poking up about the demon creature's thin tuft of black hair. Neither did that hair hide the creature's horns, thumb-sized and curling in toward each other at the top of the demon's brow. The texture of its skin was rough and thick, an armored hide, reddish in hue and shiny, as if lit by its own inner glow. Shining, too, were the demon's eyes, pools of liquid black at most times, but shifting to fiery red orbs, living flames when the demon was agitated. A glow of absolute hatred. The creature flexed and stretched, extended its wings to their full glory, reached and clawed at the air with its human-like arms. The demon extended its fingernails, transformed them into hooked claws, and grew its teeth. Two pointed canines extending down over its bottom lip. Every part of the demon was a weapon. Devastating and deadly. And yet, this demon's real strength lay in its mind and its purpose. The tempter of souls, the twister of hearts, the maker of lies.
How long has it been? How many decades, centuries have passed since my last visit to Corona?
The creature remembered that long ago time now, savored the thoughts of the streaming blood as army after army had joined in delicious, desperate battle. You saw again the elf who had rallied the humans and the other elves, Terranin Denoniel, who chased the Dactyl's armies back to the base of the mountain, Edar. Denoniel himself had come into this cave after the beast, had skewered the Dactyl. Yet even in its death throes, the Dactyl had won the day, using its willpower to bring up the magma from the bowels of Ada. Denoniel and much of his army had been consumed and destroyed.
I am eternal. I have returned. My physical wounds healed. What man, what elf will take Denoniel's place?
Its thoughts turned from its enemies to those it would summon as minions. What creatures could the Dactyl gather this time to wage its war?
The goblins, certainly, full of anger and greed, delighting in murder and war. The Formorian giants of the mountains, few in number, but each with the strength of a dozen men, and a hide too thick and tough for a dagger to puncture. And the Powrys, yes, the Powrys. The cunning, warlike dwarves of the Julianthes, the Weathered Isles, who hate the humans above all others.
A line of drool hung low from the Dactyl's mouth, as it considered its former and future allies, its army of woe.
I will bring them into my fold, tribe by tribe, race by race, growing as the night grows when the sun touches the western horizon. Hear me, Corona. Your twilight is at hand. I am awake!
Graphic Audio proudly presents R.A. Salvatore's epic saga, The Demon Wars. Coming soon.
If you can't find that hot Graphic Audio title you're looking for, just head to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD or MP3 disc format. Or, the fastest and cheapest way, download that puppy and play it on any of the many devices that'll play Windows Media. And if you're on the road or just a total computer feeb, snatch up the phone and call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220 or www.graphicaudio.net.